morning. My name is Michael McCusker. What is the meaning of it, Watson? Sherlock Holmes asks. What object is served by this circle of misery and violence and fear? It must tend to some end, or else our universe is ruled by chance, which is unthinkable. But what end? There is the great standing perennial problem to which human reason is as far from an answer as ever. And that was Sherlock Holmes, as written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle a century and more ago. I start with the celebration or commemoration, and sometimes the negative side. Radioactivity, the 100th anniversary of public broadcasting. Since its inception, public radio has had a crucial role in broadcasting history, from FDR's fireside chats to the internet age. And this is by Marina Kossler Rubin. With the flip of a switch in 1910, Lee DeForest ushered in an era of radio communications that would provide instant, long-distance wireless communication. On January 13, 1910, tenor Enrico Caruso prepared to perform an entirely new activity, sing opera over the airwaves, broadcasting his voice from the Metropolitan Opera House to locations throughout New York City. Inventor Lee DeForest had suspended microphones above the Opera House stage and in the wings and set up a transmitter and antenna. A flip of a switch magically sent forth sound. The evening would usher out an old era, one of dot-dash telegraphs, of evening newspapers, of silent films, and of soapbox corner announcements. In its place, radio communications would provide instant, long-distance, wireless communication. In 2009, America celebrated the 40th anniversary of the creation of National Public Radio. Thanks to DeForest, 2026 marks past the centennial of the true birth of the era of public broadcasting. Wireless telephony had been several decades in the making. European experimenters, including Heinrich Hertz, for whom the radio frequency unit Hertz with a Z is named, had contributed to the field in the late 1800s by experimenting with electromagnetic waves. In the 1890s, Guglielmo Marconi invented the vertical antenna, transmitting signals of ever-increasing distance. By 1901, he could send messages from England across the Atlantic Ocean to Newfoundland. Thanks in part to these advances, in December 1906, Canadian inventor Reginald Fessenden was able to arrange a holiday broadcast to operators off the Atlantic seaboard. His singing, violin playing, and biblical verse reading were heard on ships from New England to Virginia. In the decade after DeForest's broadcast, popular interest in radio technology grew. Amateur devotees became known as fans, quote unquote, rather than listeners, also a quote and unquote, or listeners in, quote unquote, which were terms used derogatorily to indicate that a person was not actively engaged in both sides of radio broadcast. Every radio at the time, or all the good ones, could both transmit and receive, explains Michelle Helms, professor of media and cultural studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Radio was a highly technical leisure activity. Fans used wire coils and spark plugs as they built receivers and transmitters at home. Early radios required multiple dial adjustments. Not everyone embraced the radio or understood how it functioned. The resulting mystery left some Americans wary. Were electromagnetic waves responsible for droughts? Skeptics blamed radios for the vibrations of bedsprings, the creaking of floorboards, even a vomiting child. In Wisconsin, people thought radios could stop cows from producing milk, says Hilms. Could the electromagnetic waves kill birds? Yes, Hilms concurs, if they flew into electrical wires. But critics could not dampen the spirits of radio fanatics. Despite a hiatus during World War I, when the government banned amateur radio broadcasting, the medium blossomed. In 1922, the United States made radio licenses available to broadcasters, and several hundred stations were founded. The 1920s showed audiences that radio was a faster means of receiving updates than waiting for the newspaper. The experimental Detroit station 8MK announced the results of the 1920 Harding-Cox presidential election to the approximately 500 locals with receivers. Others, eager for speedy news, gathered outside the Detroit News, which shared results by megaphone and lantern slide. Also broadcast live were the oral arguments and verdict in the Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925. As more events were captured on the radio, more fans built and bought sets. From 1922 to 1923, the number of radio sets in America increased from 60,000 to 1.5 million. In 1922, there were 28 stations in operation. By 1924, there were 1,400. Among the biggest commercial broadcasters were the National Broadcasting Company and the Columbia Broadcasting System, formed in 1926 and 1927, respectively, and still familiar as television networks NBC and CBS. In the 1920s, more than 200 colleges, universities, and other educational organizations had requested broadcasting licenses, but 75% of these stations folded by 1933. Hilms points out that educational radio did particularly well in the Midwest, where stations could broadcast to land-grant college communities interested in agriculture. Still, in many regions, nonprofits struggled to maintain control of their bandwidth in the presence of companies using the new economic model for broadcasting, advertisement-based programming. Promotions for Pepsodent toothpaste and Ivory soap sneaked their way into the living room between weather, news, sports, and entertainment. The Great Depression forced a lull in radio development, but still, by 1931, radio's golden age, quote unquote, had begun. Half of America's homes had radios. Mothers listened in the morning, children after school, and fathers with their families during primetime broadcasts. Isolated rural citizens could listen to sermons and gospel music from their farmhouse kitchens. In 1932, the nation awaited updates about the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh's baby from their kitchen windows. Starting on March 12, 1933, families could hear Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Sunday evening fireside chats. You might remember he was president then. During World War II, 9 in 10 families owned a radio, and they listened to an average of 3 to 4 hours of programming a day, using it as their main source of news. By 1940, over a quarter of American automobiles came with radios, ready for the early equivalent of today's driveway moments, quote unquote. Just as radio reached its zenith, a new industry took hold. According to Michael C. Keith, American radio scholar and associate professor of communication at Boston College, the 1950s began with the, quote, fear that radio was finished as a consequence of television, unquote. Radio had created dramas, sitcoms, soap operas, the same broadcasting genres that television now took for itself. As listeners became viewers, most in peril were educational and non-commercial radio. They relied on grants now directed to television alone. In 1964, the Ford Foundation, formerly the main funder of educational radio, completely cut its support. But radio did not fold. In fact, it prospered. Keith cites several factors. The creation of the transistor allowed radios to become smaller and more mobile. Also, as radio stations studied demographic data, they were able to cater more specialized programming to their audiences. Perhaps most important, though, was the emergence of a new type of music. Keith credits rock and roll with creating the youth culture in America, and as the music took to the airwaves, so did under 21 listeners. Over the course of the next decade, interest grew in the idea of publicly funded broadcasting. President Lyndon Johnson had supported the Carnegie Commission on Educational Television, which researched this question. When the committee recommended federal funding for television alone, several radio professionals agitated for the inclusion of, quote, and radio, unquote, in the forthcoming bill. Indeed, Johnson's 1967 Public Broadcasting Act established the federally funded Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which in turn created National Public Radio in 1969. Over the next 40 years, NPR accumulated member stations nationwide. Commercial broadcasting also continued to flourish. Talk radio began to dominate the AM broadcast band, with music shifting to the clear FM band. In 1987, the Federal Communications Commission repealed the Fairness Doctrine, a 1949 policy that required broadcasters to show both sides of controversial issues. The repeal continues to buoy AM talk radio today. Eventually, the AM and FM bands were joined by XM and other satellite radio services, extending the medium's reach in the 21st century. What, then, is the future of radio? Internet, says Keith. Brick and mortar has given way to cyberspace, he says. Younger audiences no longer listen to traditional radio. Rather, quote, they are their own programmers, unquote. Keith sees this coming decade as a time of transition, when radio stations will refine their internet presence to be ready for the terminus point, which is a quote, not too far into the future, when their old form broadcast will fold. We owe much of the continued success of public radio broadcasting, of all radio broadcasting for that matter, to the efforts of DeForest and his contemporaries. But there is a little bit more to the story of DeForest's 1910 endeavor. The truth is, when Lee DeForest flipped the switch at the Metropolitan Opera House during the first American public radio broadcast, audience heard almost nothing. Static and radio interference muddled the music of Cavaliera Rusticana and Pagliacci, the performances that evening. As Keith puts it, the quote-unquote great self-promoter, De Forest, was ultimately granted the title of Father of Radio, but with some reserve. That night in 1910 gained significance mainly as a symbol. It marked the intended start of a century of broadcasting, a golden age of radio eventually eclipsed mid-century by the rise of a new box, the television. Today, 100 years after DeForest's experiment, the Metropolitan Opera makes its performances available on the internet, our modern-day wireless wonder. But listeners and fans alike can still hear the Met's radio broadcast on Saturday afternoon on NPR, National Public Radio. And these days, the music is crystal clear. And now the other side of the coin, the yang. Corporation for Public Broadcasting formally dissolves after federal funding cuts. Board of directors vote to dissolve organization after nearly 60 years in operation, after funding cuts under Trump. And this is written by Lorraine Aretani in New York Magazine. The nonprofit charged by Congress with allocating funds to NPR, PBS, and other U.S. public radio and television stations announced is dissolving after massive federal funding cuts under Donald Trump. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, has announced that its board of directors had voted to dissolve the organization after nearly 60 years in operation. Patricia Harrison, president and CEO of CPB, said in a statement that the organization's board of directors voted to dissolve the organization as it faced a profound responsibility. She added, CPB's final act would be to protect the integrity of the public media system and the democratic values by dissolving rather than allowing the organization to remain defunded and vulnerable to additional attack. The organization was created by the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, which built the organization to support NPR and PBS, along with 1,500 locally owned and operated public media stations. The organization was tasked with distributing $500 million worth of funding annually to NPR, PBS, and its network of local broadcast stations. Trump and his conservative allies have long criticized PBS and NPR. Plans to quit funding for public broadcasters were outlined in Project 2025, the right-wing manifesto for a second Trump administration. And by May of last year, Trump had sent a memo to Congress demanding it take action to cut off CPB's funding. For years, taxpayers have been on the hook for subsidizing NPR and PBS, which spread radical woke propaganda disguised as news, Trump's memo said. In July, Trump wrote on social media that any Republican who voted against funding cuts, quote, to allow this monstrosity to continue broadcasting will not have my support or endorsement, unquote. The Republican-controlled Congress would go on to cut $1.1 billion in funding from CPB, forcing the organization to shut down operations in August. Public broadcasting stations have been essential for news deserts in much of the country where traditional media, especially newspapers, have shut down in recent decades. Over half of the 544 public radio and TV stations that received CPB funding were considered rural giving 99% of Americans access to public media. The cuts to federal funding have inspired donors from across the country to form a rage-giving spree, sending $70 million in donations to public broadcasters over the last year. But it's unclear how long the broadcasters can survive on donations alone. One analysis estimates that 15% of local stations are at risk of closing in 3 years because of the cuts. In a statement, Ruby Calvert, chair of the CPB's board of directors, said that it is, quote, convinced that public media will survive and that a new Congress will address public media's role in our country because it is critical to our children's education, our history, culture, and democracy to do so. So that's just another very important reason to dump Trump. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. How many of you think you remember when you first realized you were alive? At the advent of each year, I think about mortality. I seem to remember an afternoon when I was in my grandmother and maiden aunt and godmother's backyard when I was about 4 or 5, when I first grokked my own sentience, though that might simply be my personal birth myth. Yet I have ever since carried that vague sense of my origin. I remember it was a sunny Southern California afternoon, and flowers abounded under a not yet very smoggy day in the early 1940s. World War II was in its ghastly horror, but it was not in the USA. The war just took Americans offshore in other parts of the world, across the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans, to Asia and Europe, and also Africa and Pacific Islands. I suppose my war experience in Vietnam a generation later was an indirect heir of earlier Marines in Korea and the Pacific Ocean Islands. That brief year-long exposure to humanity's worst of all trait of exterminating itself for trivial purposes of imperial ambitions, of hatred and revenge, saturate my personal outlook of sentient life. Yet, now in my mid-80s, I am not at all tired of living. I just am weary and soured of humanity's inhumanity, especially that of which I played a brief part. So, if it's not too late, Happy New Year.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.